Welcome everybody to a live taping of the Radio Book Club, which is a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. And for the second year, we are doing a live taping of it at the bookstore in honour of Independent Booksellers Day. And Arsene Kashyana has put on a wonderful event here today for Independent Booksellers Day. And we have a wonderful book that we've been reading and a great local author.
Yeah, we're excited about today. It's great to do it on Independent Bookstore Day in the store, and it's very special for us because we won the Publishers Weekly Best Bookstore in the country this year, so it kind of means a lot to us to So to celebrate, I thought it would be fun to invite a local author on who's been doing great work for a long time, Elizabeth Hyde, and she has a new book out, Go Ask Fanny, which really talks about this family and a weekend that they have, and then also flashes back to a very pivotal moment in the family's life from 1984. And so we have Elizabeth with us today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here, Elizabeth. And I think this book resonates on so many levels. People who have grown up with siblings, people who have maybe complicated relationships with their family, and then people who have a sense of nostalgia about what the family has been, particularly if there's been any kind of trauma in the family. So tell us a little bit about the protagonists here. We've got the Blairs, this family. We meet them in adulthood with the three grown siblings, but then there are flashbacks to a previous time with another sibling and the mother, but the three siblings have gathered at their dad's house.
They've come up for a weekend to their dad's farmhouse in northern New Hampshire, and the oldest is named Ruth. And Ruth is a type A personality. She's an attorney for a high-powered firm in Washington, D.C., and she's kind of the bossy girl of the family. Then there's George. George is the middle child. George is an ICU nurse, and he runs marathons, and the reason he runs marathons is because he has a voracious appetite. And when he was small, he had this voracious appetite, and he swelled up, so he started running to lose weight and then got addicted to it, probably like a lot of people in Boulder. And then the youngest is Lizzie. Lizzie is impetuous and unpredictable. She's 37 years old. She's in a relationship with a much older man. It's not a very healthy relationship, and his father has kind of summoned Ruth ostensibly to the farmhouse to help persuade Lizzie to get herself out of this relationship.
So when they get to the farmhouse, Ruth and George are in the car, and they're already arguing. You know, it's interesting, when we're with our siblings, and what I found so true in this book is suddenly you're 13 again. You know, it doesn't matter how much of your life has passed, and if you're a powerful attorney in your real life, suddenly you're 13 or 15 or 17 again. And so they've kind of already fallen back into that childhood dynamic almost immediately between the airport and the house.
Yeah, the write-up has its tense moments. One of them is when Ruth starts complaining about how much money it costs to get her dog groomed, and then she says, well, this is nothing, though, compared to the doggy acupuncture. And George just cracks up, and he knows how to get Ruth's goat, and he does.
But that idea of sibling relationships, when siblings grow up, very often their relationship never matures, and it's often stuck at a time that either maybe one of the siblings left the family unit, or frozen in time, maybe at a time where there's been a trauma or some type of dislocation, which is what happened with the Blairs. I mean, is this something that you wanted to explore, this immaturity that we often have in terms of a relationship with our siblings?
That's a really good point. And I came about this from the perspective of having already written the book and then going back and realizing that I had frozen these characters in time at the time of this major trauma. Ruth is all of a sudden called upon as a 16-year-old to be the mother of Lizzie, so she's suddenly really the boss. And George has to take care of Lizzie, and he becomes a caregiver. And Lizzie just is oblivious to everything, and that's her personality. So they are all kind of frozen in time at that moment.
And what about the father's relationship? Because we meet him, he's hosting them all at the house, and then we learned that he's getting older, he's becoming more frail. Ruth really has called everyone together to figure out a plan for him in his older age. But the relationship of a parent to the siblings and how a parent can get involved or maybe even exacerbate some of those problems when we see siblings having those kind of immature relationships?
Yeah, I've often thought that the kids get along much worse when they're in Murray's presence. And it's almost as though they're still vying for his attention. But Murray he's 81. He lives alone at this farmhouse in northern New Hampshire. He's still very, very attached to his children, but he has this dream of taking off for this fishing village in Mexico. And it amazes him how he hasn't told his kids about this, and it amazes him when they all start speculating about what he should maybe do for the next winter. Ruth thinks that he ought to come down and stay in her mother-in-law unit in D.C., and George thinks that he's just fine staying there in New Hampshire. And Murray is fantasizing about going off to this fishing village in Mexico, and he thinks it just amazed him how far off base his kids were when it came to understanding what a man at age 81 really wanted to do.
You know, he's very caring towards his children, but he doesn't really show it. He's a man of that generation in New England. But we soon learn, the book opens in present time, but we soon learn that something really terrible has happened, you know, 30 years earlier. You know, first of all, the mother's missing and she's been gone for a long time, and there was a fourth sibling who was gone. As an author, and you eventually reveal what happens, and we can talk about that more later, but as an author, choosing to start it in the present day with those kind of holes in their lives, and then going back, you're kind of deciding when to give that information to the reader. How was the story always structured like this, or had you thought maybe to start it in 1984 when those events first occurred?
It wasn't always structured like this, but it wasn't structured with my beginning in 1984. I was alternating the chapters so that I had a present chapter and then a 1984 chapter, and then a present chapter and then a 1984 chapter. And it was just too disjointed. And I really did want to have kind of the absence be a presence in the novel. In other words, the absence of Lillian be a factor, a glaring omission. And you do know that Lillian has died. There are references to a fourth sibling, but I just wanted to keep it very vague so that you are compelled to read on to the second section of the novel, which is when you do find out what happens in 1984.
Well, the thing that's so surprising to me about the second section when you go back to 1984 is Lillian is such a powerful character. She really takes over the novel for that section and kind of changes the complexion of it. And you can see what a tremendous hole has been wrenched in the family by losing her that long ago. You know, making her, she's somebody who wants to write, but her writing career is interrupted because she got married and she had Ruth right away, but she persists and she's trying to write. But she's just a really powerful person who really takes over that novel to some extent.
I'm glad to see that you read it that way, because I intended for her to be that kind of a strong person. And she's the bad cop with kids. Murray is the good cop. And Lillian is the one. The title actually comes from her reliance on this Fanny Farmer cookbook. And she relies upon this cookbook so much, not only for cooking ideas, but to jot notes for the stories that she wants to write in the margins of this cookbook. She relies upon it so much that it becomes a stand-in for all the questions that she can't answer. So that if somebody says, "Mom, what's for dinner?" she will say, "I don't know, go ask Fanny." Or if somebody says, "Why can't we have pizza on Sunday nights like normal people?" she goes, "I don't know, go ask Fanny." And then, "Why is this family so crazy? Ask Fanny." So she becomes the stand-in for all the answers that Lillian doesn't have.
And then the book has this that stand-in role years later, almost as an emotional crutch, because one of the pieces of drama in the modern setting of the novel is that the book is damaged a little bit, and it's due to Lizzie lending it out to this older boyfriend of hers, and people are just distraught about this, and that kind of becomes a catalyst.
But the kids pass this book. They've come up with an elaborate thing. I mean, they live in three different places, and yet what they do is one kid has the book for a year, then the next kid has the book for a year, then the next kid, right? They're just rotating this. And we're talking, you know, we open the book 32 years after the mother's death. So to still be, this book is such a talisman for this family. And now Lizzie's boyfriend has damaged it. He's dropped it in the sink, and it's the pages are all warped. And that really sets off kind of the events and the conflict of this meeting together, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's the catalyst. Lizzie arrives at the farmhouse. George and Ruth arrive the night before on a Friday night, and Lizzie comes down. She's late the next morning. She's supposed to bring a coffee cake, and George is getting a little antsy because he's hungry. And they were saying, well, where is Lizzie? And Lizzie finally arrives with a coffee cake, but with also a six-pack of beer. And she says, don't hassle me. You know, Ruth is looking at her like, what are you doing drinking beer right now? And Lizzie's, don't hassle me, I've had a very rough morning. And she reveals that not only has Gavin dropped this cookbook into a sink full of water, but Lizzie, in response, given her impetuous nature, has taken a kettle full of boiling water and poured it on Gavin's laptop. Gavin himself has lurched for his laptop as she's pouring the water on it, and in doing so gets the water poured on his hand, and so Gavin ends up in the emergency room. So that sets everything in motion.
I was interested to see, you know, Gavin's a writer of some repute in the novel, and Lillian was a writer, and of course you're a writer. So to a writer writing writers, I guess, you know, I wanted to ask you about that. And how much of Lillian's story is somewhat your own, trying to write when you had children? And how much is Gavin's story your own? Because you've had some success and you've gotten things published, unlike Lillian.
Well, I identified a lot with Lillian because when I had published two novels by the time my children were born. And I was trying to write a third novel when they were very young. And there's a scene in Go Ask Fanny where Lillian strings a rope across the stairs to her third floor bedroom, which is her office, to keep the kids from coming up. It's kind of like a signal. And I have to admit, that does come from real life. I did have a bungee cord, and I screwed in two hooks to the railing and strung this bungee cord across to keep the kids out. It did not work. The kids came down anyway. But I think I was going back in time to a period very, very early on, before I'd published anything, where you're writing and you're sending out your stories and you're not getting any feedback from anybody. You are wondering if you can call yourself a writer. You can say, I write, but you feel like a fraud saying I'm a writer because you haven't published anything. And I was reading an interview with Toni Morrison in the Paris Review interviews, and she talks about women being given permission to not just write, but to be a writer and to have some success. And I thought that was really interesting, because men just kind of take it for granted that they can write and be a writer and have success. And women, with their children, I think, need a little bit more oomph. They need somebody to stand there saying, yeah, you can do it. It's okay, you can do this.
Well, in addition to the kids, Murray also has political ambitions, and so in many ways, Lillian's writing efforts get put on pause as he's campaigning, and she seems to have these roles imposed upon her, that she, you know, steps up to the plate and takes them on, but it wasn't her first choice, being a mother, and maybe being a wife, and certainly being the wife of a potential politician.
Yeah, Lillian's definitely a leftover of the feminine mystique, identified in 1963 by Betty Friedan, and she is somebody who is expected to be the housewife and mother, expected to be fulfilled in that role. And even though Murray wants to support her in her writing activities, Murray makes it hard for her. He dumps a big home remodeling project on her when she's just getting some time and space to get her writing going. He doesn't volunteer to stay home with the kids when they're sick. And it makes sense. I mean, he's the breadwinner. He's a lawyer, so he's bringing in the paycheck. But Lillian doesn't have that permission, really, to be a writer. And it really does. She's also supposed to be a good candidate's wife, too, and project a smile and stand up there beside her husband and make sure that the kids all have clean clothes on and look presentable.
And she does that to the best of her abilities.
She does.
Not always successfully. Well, for our radio listening audience, this is a live taping of the Radio Book Club, which is a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, the news director at KGNU. Arsene Kashkashian, who's the head buyer here at the bookstore. As always, my co-host and our guest today is Elizabeth Hyde. We're talking about her brand new novel, Go Ask Fanny. And we're doing a live taping of this at the Boulder Bookstore to celebrate Independent Booksellers Day. And this year, that the bookstore has been honoured as the best bookstore in the world, but in the country.
Sure,
what's the official title?
It's like the World Series, right? So, you know, we could just say, if it's the United States, it's the world, right? No, but it's for the United States, and we're very honoured to get it, and it's been a thrill, and couldn't do it without the people of Boulder.
Well, for the audience who's here physically in the bookstore, this radio interview will be broadcast on KGNU on May 24th. The fourth Thursday of every month, you can hear us in conversation with wonderful authors. And it's a podcast as well, so you can always subscribe to the Radio Book Club as a podcast. But Elizabeth, we were talking about you as a writer, writing about writers. At the very end of the book, there's a situation where the stories that Lillian had written are rediscovered by her children. Mm-hmm. And then there's a conversation about what to do with them, whether to publish them, whether to make them accessible to other people. And what is that like as an author to think about somebody else having ownership of stuff that you have written?
Scary. Really scary. In fact, I've lately been going through my files because there are things that I don't want my children reading. I don't want them ever thinking that they can show them to anybody else. These are truly garbage files. But I think Lillian had, I think the kids know that they're keeping this in the family. They're going to publish this collection of their mother's stories, and it's not going to go anywhere but the three kids. So I think they feel quite justified in doing that. And if I can get through my old file cabinets and get rid of all this garbage that's down there, then maybe what I'll leave behind is something that I won't mind my kids reading. There are the journals, and I've started reading my journals. Oh, my God, God help us.
But that's a wonderful glimpse into your life that you could leave as, you know, a gift to your kids.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to do that?
Yeah.
You just want to edit them first, maybe.
I definitely need to cut and not paste.
I was a little disappointed in a way, for two reasons, that they weren't going to try to publish them wider. One was because Lillian, you know, had wanted that for herself, and towards the end of her life, she does finally get an acceptance letter, but it turns out to be too late. But the other reason too was you crafted so many great beginnings to stories by Lillian. Like in the book, we hear Lillian thinking of the first paragraph or two of some of these stories, and they mm-hmm. just seem so wonderful. And it seems like if you stumbled upon these stories, you'd want to share them. I mean, you know, the couple having sex with their skinny dipping at their neighbor's pool while the neighbors are on vacation, and you know, all these different things. The plumber story, all sorts of things. So, I would think that maybe there's a chance that one of those stories will slip out into the world.
Maybe I'll write it. I did have a good time writing these stories that Lillian was writing, and only one of them is written in enough entirety that you can get really a sense of what it's about. The rest of them are just starts that I include in the story. But when I knew that I had to write in Lillian's voice, I knew I had to get out of my own voice and into somebody else's, because otherwise it would just seem like something that I was writing. And I started reading the beginnings of a lot of short stories, and one that, you know, George Saunders' short stories just start off so bizarre, and I kind of wanted for Lillian to have that kind of bizarre notion. One of her stories begins, "Once Virginia realized that she could have sex with the plumber and get away with it, she schedules all sorts of home repairs." And then her husband comes along, and he's, unbeknownst to Virginia, he's got plans to sell the house. So he's thrilled that she's getting all these repairs done. And he, in fact, gives her a long list of repairs that he wants done. So that one is one that I think I would like to follow through on.
So I was hoping we could hear you read a little bit.
Sure.
And one of the, you know, the book, we talked about 1984. That's when Murray, the husband, is running for the campaign. And all the kids are being in listed to help him on the weekends, which is somewhat awkward because Ruth and Daniel, are the two oldest, are now fully into teenage years, and they might not want to be put into the Blair Mobile and made to dress nicely and show up at campaign stops every weekend. And Lillian herself has proven to be a bit of a difficult campaign wife. When pressed on the issue of abortion, she really lashes out at somebody at an event. But this is towards the end of the campaign, and as that section from 1984 is culminating, and I thought maybe you could... So Ruth, the oldest daughter, wants to help out her father at the final campaign stop, and so she's worked up a little speech that she's going to give, too. And so I thought maybe you could read this section. People get a feeling of the voice in the story and just kind of what happens.
Sure. They're all seated in the living room, and Ruth is standing in front of the fireplace. George has a big bowl of popcorn. He's treating it like movie night. And Ruth begins to speak. "I'm up here because I believe in my father," she said, addressing the seascape above the sofa. "I believe in the things he stands for." She went on to touch on all of Murray's talking points, and it struck Lillian that Ruth had a flair for oratory, something she hadn't realized. Her mind leapt ahead, and she saw Ruth becoming a lawyer in her time, maybe even running for public office herself someday. And she imagined the pride she would feel watching Ruth speak with the moral convictions that Lillian and Murray had instilled in her since the beginning. She looked at all of her children, and despite her sour attitude toward the campaign these days, she suddenly felt such love for them. Ruth up there looking poised and unruffled and so sure of herself. Daniel going through this awful phase, but coming out a man who could make people laugh, take them out of their bad moods, and inject them with a sillier view of life. George taking care of others the same way he'd always taken care of Lizzie. And jumpy little Lizzie living outside the mold, doing whatever she chose to do. Her love was visceral. It rose from her gut up through her chest and into her throat like smoke, and with it came a terrifying sense of loss because there was so much at stake in the very fact of their lives. She had the sudden conviction that despite all the normal day-to-day discord, her children would one day be as tightly aligned as a jigsaw, that after she and Murray were long gone, the four of them would turn to each other, lean on each other, love each other to the ends of the earth, and that she had had a hand in this and could give herself a pat on the shoulder for a job well done.
Of course, that vision didn't really come true in terms of the kids when they grow up and their relationship.
No, it doesn't. I think Lillian would have been a little bit disappointed.
But maybe if she had still been alive, though, things might have been a little bit different, do you think?
That's true. She could have been the bad cop and talked some sense into them, maybe in their 20s. Like, what are you going to do the rest of your life? Are you going to bicker like a couple of 13-year-olds? She might have had an effect on them. That's a good point. I like that.
Well, I feel that the events that happened in 1984 have set them so far off the course of what their life was going to look like. Lizzie's just a 6-year-old. But as 6-year-olds do, or even kids who are a bit older than that, she blames herself for what happened in the past, and she has to live her whole life feeling that way, which, of course, that changes her personality. I mean, if the tragedy had not happened, she would not have gone through her whole life like that. And I was very touched by that just how you think things are going one way, and just one day in your life, and you can affect so many people and the whole family.
Yeah, Lizzie bears a burden which doesn't come out until the very end of the book, and so I don't want to give away any spoilers, but she definitely feels responsible. She was 6 years old at the time of her mother's death. It was a snowy night, and I'll leave it at that.
That idea that kids bear this burden, Murray, when he kind of discovers that Lizzie has borne this burden, he's quite surprised, which I was surprised at that. And maybe it was because it was in the 80s and we weren't as aware about the impact of trauma. It didn't seem like any of the kids had gotten counseling, particularly Lizzie, who was right there when her mother died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Murray himself gets some counseling. And I can't remember if this made it into the final version in the book or not. That's a problem with what you publish versus what you've written all these years. I think it made it into the final version that Murray himself got some counseling and felt incredibly weak, which is an incredibly New England of a certain age, of a time and place, way to feel. For a man who's the head of a household in the 1980s to feel like he needs counseling, that just did him, and that was not something that he thought that he could, that he thought was necessary for him.
Do these characters live on after you've published the book? Do you put them in their little drawer and move on, or they live in their lives somewhere else?
That's a good question, because usually I put them in that fictional drawer. But I'm working on a new novel right now in which I'm taking Ruth from this novel and Evelyn from, she's a character from In the Heart of the Canyon, and I'm putting them in a writer's group together. I don't know if this is going to work. I've never done this before. And I may be sick of writing about writers, but they all go off to Mexico because one of them publishes a story or publishes a novel. And so it's about a trip to Mexico with these five women. One of them is Ruth, one of them is Evelyn. So Ruth is definitely living on, and Lizzie and George, by extension, are going to be living on. But I don't know whether it'll work. Who knows? It's keeping me busy right now.
Well, we've been talking about Go Ask Fanny, which is the latest novel by our guest today, Elizabeth Hyde, who's been visiting us at the Radio Book Club, which is a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. You can hear it on the fourth Thursday of every month at 9 a.m. Catch the podcast anytime you want. And also, there's an after hours at the book club that's also on the podcast. And we're going to invite Elizabeth to stay with us, and we'll chat a little bit more and take some questions from the audience. But as we always do, we announce the next book that we're inviting folks to read along with us. And that's in June. Arson, yeah. Who will people be reading?
We're going to read a book of short stories, A Wayland, by Ramona Ausubel. Ramona Ausubel is a great young writer who recently moved to Boulder in the last year or two. And this story collection is organized kind of by geography. And some of the geography is imaginary, some is kind of magical, and some is real. She's one of these writers that will mix in all these different elements to create her stories. And so I think it'll give us a lot to talk about.
And you can hear that interview on Thursday, June 28th at 9 a.m. on KGNU. But in the meantime, Elizabeth Hyde, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.